All right, thanks. Thanks for having me. It was a great day yesterday talking with everybody in the coffee shop, and I guess it's nice to be in the building for a few hours too. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a variety of different things related to CMB foregrounds. So let me just jump right into it. Right, so quick, just to set the stage, I want to review a little bit of background before we get into the details. We're all familiar with CMB. I think it's worth stepping back and thinking about what we've learned and what the open questions are, sort of in cosmology in general, but especially CMB cosmology. So we've learned a lot about cosmological parameters in the last, say, 20 years, things like the age of the universe, how much matter there is, what its spatial curvature is. We've learned a lot about the properties of the fluctuations. For example, they're drawn from nearly invariant power spectra, Gaussian properties. They're adiabatic in the sense that all the components fluctuate in the same way. And there's also super Heisenberg correlations. So what's left to figure out in cosmology, given all this progress? I think the big questions are basically related to how structure has evolved from this initial time, which is connected to the physics of neutrinos, as I'll talk about, dark energy or potentially modified gravity. There's astrophysical questions about how galaxies have formed, where baryons are located today, which is basically a question of how feedback processes have impacted matter distribution. And then lastly, of course, one of the big fundamental questions is what seeded the initial fluctuations. So I'm going to focus today on the first and third questions and the relevance of foregrounds specifically to these questions. So first, talking about CMB lensing, and then later I'll talk about CMB polarization and hopefully also CMB spectral distortions. I just want to mention that there is a tight coupling in particular between these first two questions in the sense that baryonic physics modify the matter distribution in a way that needs to be understood if you want to extract very precise constraints on these fundamental physics questions. All right, so for the first part of the talk, we're going to think about the CMB as a backlight that's illuminating all the structure in the universe between us and the surface of last scattering. So in this schematic, we're over here on the right at redshift zero, the present day. Over here on the left is the Big Bang, and then surface of last scattering a few hundred thousand years afterward. CMB photons traverse this entire expanse, and interesting things can happen to them along the way. These go under the name of the secondary anisotropies in the CMB. So first of all, let me talk about deflection processes, gravitational lensing, CMB photons. This just refers to the fact that the paths of the CMB photons are bent by the gravity of all the intervening matter along the line of sight. For example, collapsed objects like clusters of galaxies, but also just larger scale linear perturbations. The nice thing about gravitational lensing is that it's sensitive to the total matter density, which includes the dark matter that we can't directly observe. So what's happening in CMB lensing? Basically, you can imagine this as just a geometric remapping of the CMB fluctuations. So it preserves the black body form of the CMB spectrally, doesn't make any changes. You can do a calculation in linear theory that shows that there's of order 50 small deflections that occur. Obviously, CMB photons undergo this random walk, and that produces a net deflection on the order of a couple of arc minutes. It's also coherent across degree scales, I'll show you in a second. That's just related to the typical projected size of the lenses. All right, so we have our photon coming in. It gets deflected in this cartoon by some gravitational potential psi, which produces deflection angle d, which is a 2D vector field in the sky. And you can basically write the lens CMB as just some remapping under this vector, 2D vector field d of the unlensed CMB. So if you look at this equation, you can think of a way that you might actually infer this field B, because of course we don't actually observe the unlensed CMB, we only observe the lensed CMB. So you can basically take this equation, just Taylor expand the right-hand side because we know that D is a small number, then Fourier transform, and then what you'll see is that there's a coupling between D and the gradient of the temperature. And what you can then do is use that coupling, which is going to couple Fourier modes in the CMB, to then basically invert this in the two-point correlation function and build a quadratic estimator for d. Or as I've written it here, it's for the lensing potential phi, of which d is just the gradient. So this is the schematic picture of how we're going to estimate CMB lensing for the purpose of this talk. The lensing potential at some scale L is just given by a quadratic combination. There's an integral here that weights these modes in an optimal way, but a quadratic combination of temperature. All right, so I want to highlight a couple of things about CMB lensing before we move on. So first of all, one unique fact about this observable is that it's sensitive to high redshift structure compared to other probes of large scale structure. So the geometric kernel that expresses the efficiency of CMB lensing is this red curve, which has a broad peak around redshift 2. You can compare that to a deep galaxy survey like LSST, even just the distribution of the LSST galaxies itself is at lower redshifts, and the lensing of those galaxies has a kernel that's even lower redshift still. So CMB lensing is pretty unique in this sense. I'm going to show you a couple of toy pictures here to give you some intuition about what CMB lensing looks like. There's a small patch of the CMB, about 3.5 degrees across. This is just the temperature field. So here's the unlensed CMB. Here's the lensed CMB. So what you can see is that roughly degree scale blobs are sort of shifting around by of order a couple of arc minutes. So if I flip back and forth between these things, if you have a good eye, you should be able to tell where most of the mass is. And this is a simulation, obviously. Does somebody who's not Kendrick want to guess? Which part of the image? The question is basically where are the blobs getting shifted around the most in this picture? I think it's pretty obvious in this example, no?
Could it be close to bluish?
But there's lots of blues.
There's lots of blues. It is a blue part. It's the upper right hand corner over here. So there's the large mass. A simulation. So this is a map of the lensing potential, which we actually computed from a ray traced N body simulation. This is work led by Jia Liu, who was a graduate student at Columbia at the time, is now postdoc at Princeton. So we use these simulations to look at beyond Gaussian statistics of CMB lensing, but I'm not going to go into that today. So this is what the physical lensing potential looks like. Here's what a reconstruction looks like using the temperature quadratic estimator I showed you earlier. For an experiment like Advanced ACT. So you can see that it's not perfect because there's irreducible noise coming from the CMB itself, as well as the experimental noise. But it's reasonably good. And if you Wiener filter this, it would look nicer. You can see by eye that there's non-trivial correlations between the input and the reconstruction. Okay, so that's all I want to say about lensing for now. Let me move on to scattering secondaries. So these are the two components of the Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect. So there's the thermal effect and the kinematic effect. And one very nice thing about these is that they are redshift independent. So first, the KZ effect. So this is what just comes from the Doppler boosting of CMB photons as they comp and scatter off of some clouds of electrons that are moving with a bulk velocity along the line of sight. So in this example, these two clusters falling towards each other, and the photons that traverse this cluster will get slightly upscattered, and then the opposite happens to this photon. So some facts about the KZ effect that are important. It preserves the black body spectrum of the CMB to lowest order because it's just a boost transformation basically between frames. The KZ fluctuations basically are given by this line of sight integral of the electron momentum field weighted by this visibility function. If you look at basically what contributes to this, you can essentially factor this out into a product of a linear theory velocity field times the nonlinear gas density field. So we've used this as a tool to probe the gas density field and to sort of solve this so-called missing baryons problem in recent times. I'm not going to talk about missing baryons today, but if you're interested, we can talk about it afterward. In addition to the KZ effect, we have the thermal SZ effect. So this refers to basically what is formally a second order effect that goes like V squared. But if you're in some region of the universe where the electrons are very hot, their thermal velocities are large enough that this can dominate over the first order KZ effect. And the regions where there's lots of hot electrons are in the intercluster medium of massive galaxy clusters where the gravitational energy budget is just high enough to shock heat the electrons to high temperatures. So the CMB photons come in here, they inverse comp and scatter off some electrons, and then they get typically blue shifted, which generates this spectral distortion I'll show you in a second. So the TSZ fluctuations in CMB are given by a line of sight integral of the electron pressure. It's the product of the density and the temperature, which just encodes the number of scatterings times the fractional energy change that each scattering induces, and then multiplied by this particular spectral function. So it's the non-black body spectral dependence, which is very unique. So here's what the spectral function looks like. Basically, you start with some initial blackbody distribution of photons, this dashed curve. You then process it through some hot gas, exaggerated for emphasis here, and the photons typically get upscattered. So you have a decrement then in the number of photons with the intensity at low frequencies and an increment at high frequencies with the null at around 218 gigahertz. So if you look at it in terms of delta intensity, that's this black solid curve here. This is the so-called spectral function of the TSZ effect. So modern CMB experiments have channels that span this whole range, usually with one at 218 gigahertz, where the TSZ is null. All right, so here's what a galaxy cluster looks like moving through the Planck bands. This is a simulation, but for massive clusters that are high signal to noise, the real data actually looks pretty much exactly like this. So you see the decrement at low frequencies, the null at 218 gigahertz, and then the increment at higher frequencies. In the real universe, there's also dust, which is included here, which changes the picture a little bit. All right, so then the last couple of secondaries I'll just briefly mention are related to the evolution of gravitational potentials. So there's the integrated Sachs-Wolf effect that comes from the decay of potentials due to dark energy. And on small scales, there's the Riesz-Yamm effect that comes from nonlinear growth. So how do we measure these things? I talked about the quadratic estimator used for lensing reconstruction already. The thermal Z effect has this unique spectral dependence. So with multi-frequency data, you can make maps of this signal using its very unique SED. And then other things like KSZ and ISW, we have to look for with cross-correlations because they preserve the blackbody spectrum and some of their other properties, for example, higher-order statistics are not quite detectable yet. All right, so I'm going to talk in the first part now, going into some detail about foregrounds in CMB lensing. So CMB lensing is not just a theoretical thing, as you probably know. This has been measured. The first detection in cross-correlation was by Kendrick with WMAP data. The first detection in autocorrelation was done by ACT several years ago. This is a CMB lensing map, I think, from the original ACT detection, with just a cartoon here to show you that what you're seeing is really this weighted projection of the matter density field. So the light patches here are over densities in this projection, and the dark patches are under densities. The state of the art is a reconstruction from Planck. So this is a nearly full sky map of CMB lensing from Planck, again with the same sort of color encoding. This is basically a weighted map of all the matter in the universe out to redshift 1100. This is pretty amazing. The way that we quantify these maps and actually constrain cosmology with them, at least so far to date, is solely through the power spectrum. So the power spectrum of the lensing potential is a four-point function of the CMB temperature, because remember, this is reconstructed from quadratic combinations of temperature. There's some integrals with L and other things that go in here, but schematically it looks like this. So the theory curve in lambda CDM is this black curve here, and then a compilation of various experimental constraints are shown in these colored boxes. So the Planck constraints are, I think, the darkest ones that you can see here, so that's kind of the state of the art. It's a 40 sigma detection from Planck, so about a 2.5% precision constraint on the amplitude of this power spectrum. With ongoing data from ACT, ACTPOL, and Advanced ACT, we expect to be comparable to this by the end of the year, and then to surpass it moving forward. So one of the things that we want to learn from measurements of CMB lensing is related to the physics of neutrinos. So one of the big questions here is what new physics is responsible for neutrino masses. We know the neutrinos have mass because of the oscillations that have been measured between the flavor eigenstates. So those give you a constraint on the squared mass differences of the three mass eigenstates. But we don't know what the absolute overall mass scale is. And cosmology is probably our most sensitive near-term tool to constrain this. In the so-called normal hierarchy, where you have two lighter neutrinos down here, the minimum summed mass is on the order of 60 millielectron volts. The inverted hierarchy, where you have two heavier ones and one lighter one, is on the order of 100 millielectron volts. So we'd like to have enough sensitivity to infer this. How are we going to do that? Basically, it's from measurements of large-scale structure. So massive neutrinos suppress the growth of structure because the fast-moving neutrinos that are born with these large thermal velocities in the early universe don't like to cluster on small scales. So this is a toy example for emphasis. This is a simulation that shows the density field at redshift zero in a cosmology with massive neutrinos. I think these have a total sum mass of 1 electron volt. So it's quite exaggerated, then without massive neutrinos here. Basically, if you just sort of look at this by eye, you can see that there's a lot more dark blue and then these small dark red regions here because the density peaks are much sharper. Without massive neutrinos, and the voids are much sort of emptier. Whereas with massive neutrinos, the structure is washed out to some extent. There's a lot more yellow and green, so things look smoother. So if you turn that into a CMB lensing power spectrum calculation, here's what it looks like. Basically, the massive neutrinos will suppress the lensing power spectrum, the same way that you see them suppressing the density fluctuations here. So this plot, which is from the S4 Science book, shows the CMB lensing power spectrum as a function of the neutrino mass while holding the other cosmological parameters constant. And although you can hardly see the difference between these curves by eye here, if you look at the fractional difference with respect to the massless neutrino case, you can see that there are changes on the order of a few or a couple percent. And the projected error bars from upcoming experiments are indeed small enough to be sensitive to the minimum allowed mass from the oscillation experiments, which is here. So that's, I think, pretty exciting. There are some subtleties involving other cosmological parameters and degeneracies that you have to worry about, but I think that sort of just looking at the back of the envelope, this motivates why it's important to understand how we can measure CMB lensing very precisely. All right, so let me move to the foreground challenges, just having motivated why we need to do this very carefully. So for temperature-based CMB lensing reconstruction, there's a list of several things we're gonna have to worry about. So first of all, let me talk about the cosmic infrared background. This is the cumulative emission of dusty star-forming galaxies over the history of the universe. This peaks, the sort of kernel of the CIB emission peaks at redshift 2, which is when the star formation rate density of the universe is also peaking. Sort of a coincidence that matches the redshift kernel of CMB lensing I showed you earlier very precisely. So these two fields are very strongly correlated on the order of 70 or 80%. And you can see that in this image here from a Planck paper. This is real data. It's hard to believe it's so high signal to noise. So this is a stack on hotspots in the CIB at 545 gigahertz, and then cold spots here. So here you have an overdensity of dusty star-forming galaxies, and here there's an underdensity. And the arrows show the lensing deflection field that's inferred from CMB lensing. So matter overdensities and CIB overdensities are extremely well matched, vice versa for the underdensities. And this is just a noise map for comparison. So this is pretty cool. All right, so we have to worry about the CIB. We also have to worry about the other secondaries I told you earlier.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So why are they, are they the same as scale here? I guess you don't show the spatial scale here.
I think these cutouts are on the order of maybe 5 or 10 arc minutes across.
Right, I guess I'm a bit puzzled why the hotspots and cold spots are the same scale, but I guess I expect.
Oh, I think that that's just the beam scale of the 545 gigahertz map.
Uh-huh. So you're saying you're not resolving like the lambda-scale structure?
You're definitely not resolving like, well, this is a stack on the hotspots, right? So it averages out and turns into this circular thing of the CIB.
So this would be like clusters, I suppose.
Well, these are, much higher redshift. I mean, there's like redshift 2 and 3 overdensities of star-forming galaxies.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, each individual one probably has some morphology that does not look so clean and circular, but after you stack 10,000 of them.
I expected some asymmetry between hotspots and cold spots because I guess hotspots. But I guess if they're all linear, then maybe that's not the case. So, yeah.
But they're defined presumably by smoothing the CIB field on some scale.
Well, you can't undo the beam smoothing, and the beam of this map is about 5 arc minutes. I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so.
What is the beam?
It's 5 arc minute full with half max. So these are probably, maybe 10 or 15 arc minutes across. Okay, so we also have to worry about the thermal SZ and kinematic SZ effects, and then there's also emission from radio point source, other point sources to worry about. So these are all challenging because not only do they have their own intrinsic non-Gaussianity that could bias the CMB lensing power spectrum I showed you earlier, which is this four-point function of the CMB temperature, but they're also correlated with the lensing field themselves. Then you also have other non-Gaussian foregrounds from our own galaxy. In temperature, I think we have enough control over these that it's not a huge worry. In polarization, it's totally uncharted territory. So I haven't talked too much about polarization lensing reconstruction, but for CMBS4, this will actually dominate the total spectrum of noise. And there's been a number of ongoing analyses, I don't think any of which have been fully completed, where we're trying to use simulations, in particular of the polarized galactic dust, to estimate how much of this could bias CMB lensing reconstruction. But I think this is still a big question mark. So I'm going to focus on this for now. So for the next, I'd say, 5, maybe even 8 years, this temperature lensing reconstruction is really going to dominate the constraints. we have to understand the foregrounds pretty carefully. So people started to look into this a few years ago, basically asking, using simulations and some level of theory calculations, how much things like thermal SZ could bias this quadratic estimator reconstruction. So this is a summary plot from a paper by Alex Van Engelen a few years ago. What we're looking at here is the fractional bias to the CMB lensing power spectrum. So this would be a 1% bias denoted by this dotted curve. And then the bands here basically represent model uncertainty on these different contributions. So we're seeing both the tri-spectrum, the intrinsic non-Gaussianity of the thermal SZ and CIB fields here, as well as the terms that come from their correlations with the lensing field that I mentioned a second ago. Fortuitously, these cancel to some extent, but the overall bias, if you do a reconstruction up to a maximum multiple of Lmax 3000, is larger than this 1% sort of target that we want to aim for. So that's an issue. They showed in this paper that you could solve it by basically masking the brightest clusters and the brightest infrared sources aggressively, and then also reducing the maximum temperature multipole that you use in this reconstruction, because the foregrounds pick up on small scales or high multipoles. If you do that, you can suppress it to be within 1% roughly. So this was kind of the situation with looking at the frequency dependent foregrounds, but nobody had looked in detail at the largest black body foreground, which is the kinematic SZ effect. No problem.
So,
yeah.
How many frequency channels are assumed? Like, is there any kind of cleaning you can do, or
In this calculation, they were assuming it was a single frequency experiment, which was kind of the situation that ACT and SPT were in at the time. Planck used their multi-frequency information to do some level of cleaning of foregrounds. I think, having looked into it in some detail, a few of us are not certain that foregrounds were all totally removed adequately. But we now have ideas about, I'll talk about it in a second, about ways that you can basically get rid of any of the non-black body foregrounds sufficiently with multi-frequency information. So going forward, that will certainly be one of the main tools we use. But the KSZ effect cannot be removed with multi-frequency information because it preserves the black body spectral dependence of the CMB. So last year, Simone Ferraro and I calculated this in detail for the first time. So first, let me show you the fractional bias to the autocorrelation, the auto power spectrum of CMB lensing. So similar to the plots that I just showed you. So there's a number of terms that you have to worry about. There's this correlated term from the correlation of the KSZ field with kappa, the lensing field. And then there's also terms that come from the intrinsic non-Gaussianity of the KSZ field itself. So the total basically is is the solid blue curve here. They do, again, cancel a little bit against each other, the different terms. But it's on the order of a few percent. This would be for a reconstruction with LMAX 4000. And it's similar for either Simons Observatory or CMB stage 4 noise level. And again, this is just for temperature. So what this would translate into is a non-negligible bias on your neutrino mass constraint, because you're getting the amplitude of the CMB lensing power spectrum wrong. There's also a bias on cross-correlations of the lensing field with large-scale structure tracers. So now we're looking again at the fractional bias, but this is the cross-correlation of CMB lensing with a fiducial galaxy survey, something like LSST. This is a larger bias because the galaxy survey comes from preferentially lower redshifts where the KSZ signal is larger. So we looked at this for several different experimental setups, something like Planck, Simons Observatory-ish, or Advanced Act-ish, and then CMB stage 4. And you can see that it becomes quite large at these high levels of sensitivity on the order of 5 or 10%. And what's even more worrying about this stuff is that baryonic physics play an important role here, because it's the KSZ signal we're talking about. You have to model things like the gas density profile of halos in the universe, and feedback processes move the gas around. So the difference between the analytic calculations, which are the solid curves here, and the simulations, which are the dashed curves, you can kind of take as a representative estimate of the uncertainty due to the baryonic physics in the KSZ signal.
Mm-hmm. Have a punchline.
I think this was
I just want to understand what is the main thing as responsible for that 10% thing? Is this kind of a square of KSZ, or is it?
Yeah, in this case, the only term that enters is this type of term. So it's a KSZ squared cross delta. So basically,
KSZ on what scale that would be contributing?
I mean, it's dominated by the smallest scales that you include in the reconstruction. So in this case, it's KSZ sort of on the order of L of 2,000 to 4,000 or something that's dominating the bias.
So it's kind of sign of RKSDS squared is modulated by kind of large, by larger scale?
Yeah, and we actually detected this directly in Planck data a couple of years ago. We built an estimator that looks like basically KSE squared cross delta galaxies and looked for it in cross-correlation with Planck and detected it. And then this is essentially the same type of thing, but just appearing as a bias to CMB lenses. Okay, so one thing that I think is interesting is that I have a suspicion that there's already signs of these biases in current measurements. So a number of us have seen some sort of puzzling issues when we cross-correlate Planck, the Planck CMB lens reconstruction with various large-scale structure tracers. Here I'm showing an example from this paper by Anthony Pullen et al., where they've cross-correlated Planck with the BOSS CMAS galaxies. And what you're seeing basically is that when you go to very low L, the data points tend to always lie significantly below the best fit theory curve that you infer using somewhat smaller scale, higher L information. We saw almost the same type of effect in our cross-correlation with Wise galaxies as well. So this looks qualitatively exactly like this type of effect where you have this deficit at low L. This, I don't think, is due to KSZ because for Planck, the KSZ is pretty small. However, these other contributions from Thermal SZ and CIB, I'm particularly worried about. It's known that the map that was used for the Planck lens reconstruction does have non-trivial Thermal SZ leakage, for example. So my personal guess is that that's probably what's going on here. So
you change the L max, I mean, for the reconstruction, how does this change?
So Planck could do that. They only released like a single map for the rest of the community to use. So if you wanted to change that, you'd have to go back in with your own pipeline and redo the whole thing from scratch. So I don't know that anybody has checked that. Yeah, that'd be a smoking gun to see that that's what this is. My hope is that the 2018 papers, we might see some plots like that. But yeah, this is the guy who knows, not me. Yeah, so this is actually something that I just said a minute ago in words. So the map that was used in the Planck lens reconstruction is this component-separated SMECA map. So without getting the details, basically SMECA is trying to do some overall variance minimization in the component separation, the multi-frequency cleaning, but it doesn't impose some explicit constraint that you're going to remove any particular foreground. It's just trying to sort of minimize the overall variance subject to the constraint that you preserve the CMB. So if you stack at the location of known optically selected galaxy clusters, in this component-separated map, you can still see Thermal SZ residuals, for example. So at 143 gigahertz, Thermal SZ signal is negative, so there's the signal from these clusters. Similarly, in the SMECA map, you can see a comparable signal at those locations. And it's not because SMECA didn't do foreground cleaning, it's just that it wasn't trying to exactly remove this particular signal. The problem is that this type of signal is a worry for CMB lensing reconstruction. There's other component-separated maps out there where people have explicitly removed, for example, the Thermal SZ signal using its known spectral dependence that I showed you earlier. And for example, this LGMCA map does that, and there's no Thermal SZ signal when you look at these locations in that map. Matt Matavotral and I wrote a paper a couple of months ago looking at a way to get around these type of foregrounds by developing a slightly different CMB lensing estimator. So there's two observations basically that underlie this. First one is that if you look at what the quadratic estimator is doing in more detail than what I showed you earlier, you're basically taking some filtered version of a gradient, the temperature gradient map, and then looking at the divergence of the product of that with some other Wiener-filtered temperature map. And the information in the temperature gradient saturates by roughly L of 2000 in the CMB, which is nice for us because Planck has measured the CMB with multi-frequency information basically up to that scale, just about. And then the second observation is that if you look at expanding out the sort of quadratic estimator reconstruction where you write it as the observed signal as the sum of the filter temperature that you want, the primordial CMB temperature, and some foreground field F, you can basically look at this, expand it out, and then take the expectation values and find that if you only clean one of the legs of the estimator, then that should be sufficient for removing biases. So in principle, you don't actually have to apply your multi-frequency component separation to both of the temperature maps that are used. So we term this asymmetric lensing reconstruction because you're doing different things now to the two temperature maps that are going into the quadratic estimator. So this turns out to work really well. So I'm showing you now, again, this fractional bias plot, in this case for cross correlations of lensing with a galaxy survey. And we're looking just at the bias from the thermal as E-signal now. So if you don't do anything, you get this well-known very large bias on the order of 10 or 20%. If you just apply this gradient cleaning trick that I mentioned here, this asymmetric lensing reconstruction, then basically the bias is totally gone. And what's nice is that you don't lose all of your signal to noise when you do this because you're not, basically the issue here is that if you wanted to clean both the legs, you'd have to use Planck in both of them. And what you're going to be subject then to just Planck noise, you're going to be back to where you were before. So what we want to do is combine the multi-frequency Planck information on this leg with a small scale map, say from ACT or SPT, which has, you know, one or two frequencies, but has much higher signal to noise in this leg. And the nice thing about this estimator is that it preserves the signal to noise while getting rid of the bias. So another example of this here is looking at the fractional bias to the halo mass that you infer if you're stacking clusters on CMB lensing maps. If you don't do anything, you get these red points here. So at high masses, there's a big bias. If you use our asymmetric lensing trick, then the bias is basically gone. So it seems like it works very well.
Does the clean, in this sense, does the clean gradient have
KSZ? This was TSZ only. Yeah. We are going to check how well this does with KSZ included. In principle, it shouldn't work super well for the KSZ because, I mean, you can't clean it with the multi-frequency information. Which I guess brings me to my last point, which is about getting around the KSZ. So I think that basically we have a method that brings all the non-black body foregrounds pretty much under control. And we've also shown that this should work with the auto power spectrum of CMB lensing. New methods I do think are needed for the KSZ bias, sort of in the next several years, while we're still dominated by temperature for the reconstruction. And just in the last few months, there have been some developments that are promising for this. So Heather Prince, a graduate student in Princeton, put together a really nice detailed paper showing how you can separate CMB lensing estimators into a magnification piece and a shear piece, sort of like in galaxy lensing reconstruction. And what's nice is that it looks like the shear piece of that is much less biased by foregrounds than the magnification piece. So Emmanuel Sean and Simone Faro took the results from the Prince estimator and then applied them to foreground maps and showed that there was much less bias than in the standard quadratic estimator. So this seems pretty promising to me. I do think that one interesting thing that's never been done, even by Planck, is to do a full end-to-end test of this entire pipeline, where you simulate the sky at every frequency you're going to observe, including all these types of correlations and biases they talked about, apply your component separation machinery, and then do lensing reconstruction on that, and see if you recover the input lensing potential. I think this would be a nice thing to see from Planck, for example, but I don't know if that's going to happen. But if we're going to detect the neutrino mass, then this is the kind of thing that I think we have to do. Okay, so that was all I wanted to say about CMB lensing foregrounds. Anybody has final questions on that? Yeah.
So I guess I'm just thinking that both KSZ and lensing are really measuring the same thing, which is kind of the potential. And of course, on a small scale, velocity is slightly different because I mean, there's a random motion associated, but it's really gradient of phi. So I mean, in principle, couldn't you have an estimator that is a combined with the information?
Yeah, I mean, the KSZ doesn't produce, it doesn't produce the same mode couplings, though, in the primary CMB, right, that lensing does. It has some intrinsic non-Gaussianity itself. Kendrick and others have worked on this.
But I mean, they're both integrals of gradient of phi. One is the radial gradient, and the other is the tangential gradient.
Yeah, although the phi that appears there is not the same, right? I mean, for lensing, it's this integrated lensing potential phi. Whereas KSZ, it's the three-dimensional Newtonian potential.
They're not exactly the same, right? No, so there's some geometrical factor of the difference. But I mean, in terms of the statistical field that goes into them is the same one with a different weighting, so to speak, right? So I guess I'm just thinking there might be an opportunity there to, instead of treating KSZ as noise to lensing, you could just basically use both information to construct the same thing.
Yeah, for this estimator that's based on sort of like KSZ squared cross large scale structure that we applied to Planck data to make that detection a few years ago, CMB lensing also contributes to that because they're both quadratic in temperature for that particular statistic. So you could definitely build an estimator that sort of picks out just one of those two type of contributions. In that paper, we didn't try to do that. We just marginalized over the lensing leakage. But yeah, you could build a bispectrum estimator that's sensitive just one or the other. Okay, so I want to say a few words about foregrounds in general now, maybe specifically looking ahead to the high precision polarization measurements. So just a lightning review in case you're not used to thinking about this. So in temperature, on the right, we have a whole bunch of different components that contribute to microwave sky. You have galactic dust, CIB I've talked about, galactic synchrotron radiation, galactic free emission, you have the thermal Z signal, you have the spinning dust, we think it's spinning dust, anomalous microwave emission, emission from CO lines, radio sources, and if you're on the ground, you also have atmosphere you have to worry about. In polarization, there's many fewer things to worry about. There's basically just polarized dust from our galaxy, polarized synchrotron from our galaxy, and then polarized point sources. In principle, it's possible that this AME is polarized, but there's no evidence of that thus far. So in addition to just worrying about the foregrounds themselves, there's interesting crosstalk between the foregrounds and other instrumental systematics, which I'm not going to talk about, but there's something else to worry about. So what we want to do basically is come up with methods to sweep away dust, these foregrounds. Sort of picture you should have in the back of your mind is that we're going to combine data at many different frequencies to preserve the CMB, which is constant in these units, which you can see at high latitude, and remove the non-black body foregrounds. In addition to this type of method, though, we have also been thinking about ways of using other ancillary galactic data, in particular, to build higher fidelity foreground templates. So this is just an advertisement of some recent and then also ongoing work with Susan Clark, who's now at the IIS. Or what you're seeing here is basically the projected magnetic field orientation on the sky inferred from the polarized dust emission at Planck. And then in the top panel, what you're seeing is essentially linear structures that we found in a neutral hydrogen survey using a machine vision technique called the rolling Hough transform that I can tell you about if you're interested. And what's interesting here is that the neutral hydrogen structures, the H1, basically trace out the projected magnetic field direction with very high fidelity. The small white arrows here are starlight polarization measurements that also tell you about the magnetic field direction and the absorption of starlight due to dust grains along the line of sight. So at low galactic latitudes, which are on the left here, the Planck data has high signal noise, so there's lots of dust. And you can see by eye that everything lines up extremely well. But at high latitudes, the Planck data becomes very noisy. So what's happening up here is not that there's some interesting magnetic field structures in Planck, but just that there's a lot of noise in the Planck data, so you can't actually infer the direction of the magnetic field very well. But the H1 data still has very high signal noise up here at high latitude. So we're building a Bayesian framework that essentially combines these two data sets on a pixel-by-pixel level to generate a higher fidelity template of what the polarized dust emission looks like in the sky. It's been a lot of work. I think we're going to have some results in the next couple of months. And the payoff should be a higher fidelity foreground template to be used in component separation for things like constraining R. Okay, I want to make a couple of other sort of general points, though, about foreground cleaning. We started thinking last year about some issues that, in retrospect, I think are kind of obvious, but nobody had pointed out before. So one issue you might have is that even if you know that the fundamental SED of your foreground, say, follows some modified black body curve, like this dust emission here, when you observe the actual sky, you're going to be taking some average of basically different emissive components that could have slightly different temperatures or slightly different spectral indices in that modified black body, which produce some average, say, within your experimental beam or along the line of sight. That's totally inevitable. You can't undo those averages. What that means is that you're averaging SEDs with slightly different spectral dependences, which produces a superposition of the spectral shapes that has new behavior. I think it's clear this should happen, but nobody had sort of calculated what exactly comes out. So here's a toy example that illustrates what I'm talking about. Let's imagine that the dust SED really was truly a modified black body, but that the spectral index of that modified black body varies on degree angular scale in the sky. So we'll draw this spectral index from some Gaussian, which has a mean that's consistent with the Planck constraint on the dust spectral index, that has some variance that's also consistent with how much variance is allowed by Planck data. If you then measure the power spectrum at all the different frequencies that you want, and then look at the spectral dependence of the power spectrum in each one of your L bins, what you're going to find is that it doesn't follow the sort of mean modified black body that you assume. But instead, there's going to be preferential deviations, which come from the variations in the spectral index coupling to derivatives of this modified black body spectral function. So that's what's shown in this plot, basically. So if you look as a function of frequency here at the SED of the dust power spectrum in L bins, you see that there's a deviation from the mean SED, which is largest on the angular scales where this variation was injected. So the plot on the right shows the residuals and sort of on degree angular scales, sort of L of 100 to 200, you get very large deviations. These are not percentages. So this is order 100% or larger mistakes that you're making. So if you did your component separation with some parametric method that assumed that it was a modified black body with a spectral index of 1.6, this type of effect would mean that you were completely wrong. And nobody seemed to have calculated these things before. So for me, this is a reason why you should not go fully parametric when you're doing component separation. You might say that you know something about the fundamental SED and what its parameters are, but you have to also know a lot about how the parameters are varying over the sky if you actually want to write down a parameterized model that could fit your data correctly. So I've mostly been focusing on what are called agnostic or semi-blind methods for component separation in my own work. The one that I've worked the most with is called internal linear combination. So I'm just gonna review how this works very quickly. You essentially just say that the observed temperature in some, say, pixel, or it could be some harmonic coefficient ALM, looks like your component of interest. In this case, we'll say it's Compton Y, the thermal Lazy signal, which has been rescaled by the known spectral function. This would be the thermal Lazy spectral function. And then everything else, including all the other foregrounds, is noise. Including not just the instrumental noise, but also the foregrounds. You can then go through a quick derivation with some Lagrange multipliers to derive the minimum variance linear combination of your data that has a unit response to this component of interest. It's given by this particular linear combination of the map with these weights here. And then the interesting thing about ILC is that it's very flexible about what type of domain you compute the covariance, the frequency-frequency covariance that appears in this expression. So I wrote it all down in pixel space here, but you could do it in harmonic space, or the sort of state of the art these days is to do it on this needlet frame, which is local both in pixel space and in harmonic space. So people have extended this model in a way where you also write down explicitly some other component whose SED you know that you want to remove. So in this case, this additional component would be the CMB itself, for example, whose spectral function is just one in temperature units. And then you can apply additional constraint in your Lagrange multiplier problem, drive this new expression for the weights that has zero response to this undesired component. So this is nice if there's some contaminant that you think might explicitly bias some analysis you're doing, like in the CMB lensing reconstruction that I talked about earlier. So when I said that this LGMCA map had deprojected thermal AZ, they imposed some constraint like this to deproject it. You can extend this to explicitly remove any number of components that you want, but then you're sort of no longer being blind in the ILC, starting to become closer to a parametric method. It can be useful, like I said, to remove contaminants that could bias some analysis, but you pay a price in the variance or the noise of the final ILC map, because you're using degrees of freedom to do this. So what I've been looking at is an extension of this, where you would write down a model as well for some component whose SED you do not know from first principles. So this could be the CIB, for example. We know that it looks roughly like a modified black body, but the parameters of that modified black body are not known to describe precision, and they also vary over, they don't vary over the sky to a huge extent, but between any two frequencies, it's not going to look like exactly the same modified black body. So the idea then is you write down this additional component, and then what you're going to do is basically sample over parameters describing that SED, and then that lets you marginalize over the foreground uncertainties basically at the ILC map reconstruction level. So I call this multiply constrained Monte Carlo ILC. It's multiply constrained because you're going to write down some model like this that includes an arbitrary number of components that you want to remove. And then it's Monte Carlo because you're going to sample over parameters that describe this SED. And there's lots of nice extensions of this. Instead of just sort of minimizing the variance in the ILC, you could instead minimize, say, the cross variance with some external tracer of the foreground, Or you could minimize some non-Gaussian statistic like this TBB bispectrum, which in some initial tests that Will Colton is doing, a student in Princeton, this looks like it might be a more effective diagnostic of B-mode dust contamination than just the BV variance itself. So I think that this is a nice thing, very flexible. I've been implementing it so far on Planck data.
So you say Monte Carlo up there, but then you say you minimize it, not marginalize it. So what does that mean? When you do Monte Carlo, you're marginalizing of it. So.
Basically, when you do the Monte Carlo, I mean, you're calculating all these different statistics at each step. It's not a markup chain. It's just like a sample. It's just a sampling procedure. And then you calculate all these things. Then afterwards, you can find the one that satisfies whatever constraint that you're looking for.
So why are you not, why don't you want to marginalize? Because it seems, I mean, you should just basically, whatever you think is a criterion, you should just add it to your likelihood and then marginalize it with an MCMC.
I mean, if you knew what the SED was that described this component, like from first principles, then yeah, there would be no need to do any sampling or anything. Like, this would be the whole calculation. You just apply this type of expression generalized to many components. The point of the Monte Carlo is to let you run this for many different sort of guesses about what this SED looks like. And then afterwards, you can measure whatever statistic you want off the maps and then marginalize over the foreground uncertainty, sort of ab initio. So take the Planck like Y maps or something, right? It's clear that these have some like leakage of dust emission into those maps, but it's extremely difficult to quantify without going back to the very beginning of the whole analysis chain. Instead, if you made the maps with this type of approach, you would make an ensemble of maps. Or for each one, you've deprojected some type of assumed dust emission SED. And then afterwards, you could measure your cross-correlation on of your external sample galaxies or whatever with all of those ensemble of Y maps. And then the spread in the results that you get immediately tells you what the foreground systematic is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So here's an example of applying this to Planck. So on the left, this is the so-called sort of standard ILC. On the upper right, this is what you get if you impose one constraint where you just deproject the CMB. So this was kind of what was already done within Planck. And then using this pipeline, looked at all deprojecting the CIB instead, assuming some SED, and then sampling over a family of SEDs with CIB. And then this map here is basically posterior mean of all of the maps that you get out. And then the bottom right is a similar thing where I've also deprojected the CMB. And it turns out that there's a fast way that you can do the linear algebra that lets you do the slow step in this whole pipeline only once, which makes this feasible to generate these ensembles of hundreds of maps. So these should be up pretty soon, which I think anybody who's doing YMAP stuff should be interested in. All right, I think I'm just about out of time. I wanted to say a few things about CMB spectral distortions. Maybe I can just very quickly walk through this. I want to highlight one result at the end. So hopefully everyone's aware that when we look at these maps, what we're seeing are temperature fluctuations. The true CMB sky looks like this, where it's just some large monopole. That's about 2.7 Kelvin. So we know that this has some black body spectrum. Also, hopefully everybody's seen this curve from Kobe Firas. This has error bars on this curve. We know that the CMB is very close to black body to one part. 50 million, yeah, within 50 parts. Okay, but what's interesting is that this is not the whole story about the spectrum of the CMB. There are known physical processes that the standard model of cosmology predicts that lead to deviations from a black body form. So a very quick summary of the thermal history of the universe in this epoch, that at very early times, everything's in full thermodynamic equilibrium. So it's just totally characterized by the rescaled temperature of the CMB, as we know. As you go to later times, lower redshifts, if you perturb this equilibrium, somehow you can get non-trivial spectral distortions. That's basically a competition between three different microphysical processes. So you have Compton scattering that we're familiar with. You have double Compton emission, which can generate new low-frequency photons. Then you have free-free or Bremsstrahlung emission, which can also generate new low-frequency photons. So what's important is that these last two processes don't conserve the overall photon number. So they are very important in terms of restoring the thermodynamic equilibrium at early times. So what happens basically in the history of the universe, in this schematic from Jens here, high redshift is over on the right now, low redshift is on the left. So in the black body era, all those processes are in equilibrium. As you drop below a redshift of about 2 million, these two processes, double Compton and Bremsstrahlung, fall out of equilibrium. What that means is that you can no longer generate new low frequency photons. Compton scattering is still efficient. So you can still achieve, kinetic equilibrium, but with a conserved photon number. And so what that means is that if you inject some energy in that time, it can't fully thermalize back to black body spectrum. So that generates a spectral distortion, the mu type distortion, with this chemical potential type parameter mu, which is related to just the amount of energy, the fractional amount of energy that you've injected. So the spectral function of mu looks like this, very similar to the Y-type spectral function we saw earlier, with a zero crossing at 125 gigahertz. As you then proceed to lower redshifts to the left, Compton scattering also falls out of equilibrium. That happens starting about redshift of 50,000. And if you inject energy after that time, you get a Y-type distortion. And this should be familiar because this is also the thermal Z effect in clusters of galaxies. But if you injected something at early times, you could also get a monopole Y-type distortion. Okay, so there's lots of interesting physics encoded here. What processes can actually lead to signals like this? So electron-positron annihilation happens too early in the history of the universe, back in the black body era. There's some guaranteed signals that people have worked out in the last 10 or 20 years. So for the mu distortion, there's one that comes from the fact that the temperature of matter redshifts is 1 plus z squared, whereas the photons just go like 1 plus z. So the electrons are basically cooling the CMB until about redshift 150, which is when decoupling happens. This is a small effect because it's suppressed by the photon and baryon ratio, so it's on the order of minus 2 times 10 to the minus 9. You could have some exotic signals from, say, decaying particles. I'm not going to focus on those today. Another guaranteed signal occurs from the dissipation of small-scale acoustic modes in the primordial plasma. And I think that this is the signal that's the most exciting. I'm going to talk about this in a little bit of detail. And this has a value on the order of 10 to the minus 8. So what you're essentially seeing here is the fact that as modes re-enter the horizon in this era, silk damping is trying to wash out structure on small scales. What's happening there is basically you have two small-scale modes interacting in the plasma. Those dissipate some energy. That energy, some of it goes into just heating the plasma, but some of it generates a non-zero U-type distortion. If you look at the actual scales that are relevant, basically you just look at the evolution of the silk damping scale as a function of redshift. So at redshift 2 million, which is the beginning of the mu era, it's over here. And then at redshift 50,000, when the mu era ends and the Y-type era begins, it's over here. So what you're seeing then from this dissipation signal in the spectral distortions is some integral of the primordial power spectrum within this window of scales. And what's exciting is that you're probing the primordial power spectrum on scales that are totally inaccessible to basically any other type of cosmological measurement. So on the order of hundreds of inverse megaparsecs. In principle, you also generate Y-type distortions from this effect, but those are swamped by the contributions from groups and clusters of galaxies at later times. And just to give you some reference, the range of the primordial power spectrum that we probe with measurements of the CMB fluctuations or large-scale structure fluctuations is all the way down here on the left, below sort of K of 0.1 and larger. So if you just look at sort of the schematic picture here, I think this is pretty cool. This is basically showing constraints on the primordial power spectrum from a variety of different observations. So all the decades of work for CMB and large-scale structure are contained in this little window here. On very small scales, you have some constraint that comes from the non-formation of primordial black holes. There are some model-dependent constraints from looking for gamma ray emission from the dark matter and ultra-compact mini-halos. I'd say those are super model-dependent. If we could make this measurement of the mu distortion in the CMB spectrum, then you basically get to extend your constraint, some integral constraint, right, all the way up to wave numbers of order 10 to the 4 inverse megaparsecs. So if you turn that into the number of inflationary E-foldings that you're probing, it roughly doubles the number of inflationary E-foldings that you're probing. I think that this is pretty amazing. Is alone enough motivation that we should go out and measure the spectrum of the CMB. There is another interesting signal that comes from late times just from the thermal Z effect in groups and clusters of galaxies. And we calculated this as well as relativistic corrections to this a couple of years ago. So I just want to end by talking about the experimental prospects for this field. There was a lot of activity in the last several years that led to us posing a mission called PIXE, Primordial Inflation Explorer, to NASA. PIXE would have been pretty impressive, a huge improvement in sensitivity over COBE-FIRAS, which was the last time the spectrum was measured. It also would have done some B-mode science as well. Unfortunately, it wasn't successful, but I do think that the spectral distortion science was very well reviewed and is motivation to look into this more in the future. So we did a lot of work to forecast the detectability of these signals for PIXE in the presence of realistic foregrounds, which is the connection back to this talk about CMB foregrounds. A lot of this work was done by Max Abitbol, who was a grad student at Columbia, moving to Oxford for postdoc next year. So in our model, basically we have, what we're seeing here is the intensity of the sky as a function of frequency. We have the CMB black body here in blue. It's just the monopole of the sky, remember. We have the monopole Y-type distortion here. This is the absolute value, some dashed curves are negative. You have a relativistic correction to that Y-type signal, which are here, which are interesting for astrophysics. And then you have the primordial mu-type distortion down here, which will let us probe the primordial power spectrum that is sort of unprecedented at these small scales. So what was exciting was that if you just looked at the PIXE noise alone, for either the nominal or extended mission, you're in the ballpark of detecting mu distortion just from the statistical sensitivity. The problem is that we have this foreground curve. So that's the dashed magenta curve up here. So here it is broken down into all the different components in the model. There's the different dust components, free-free and synchrotron, which pick up on low frequencies, some CO lines, and then spinning dust down here. So the worry was that we were trying to dig out this small signal from underneath these much larger foregrounds. And nobody had actually done this calculation until we looked into it, including all the different foregrounds in the sky. So the punchline is this sort of projection. So we did both Fisher calculations and full MCMC. So the story is promising for basically everything except mu. So you detect the Y-type distortion, even the relative to the corrections to that at very high signal to noise. Unfortunately, the mu distortion, although it looks detectable in a statistical sense, which it is, it's sort of 4 or 5 sigma detection just with the statistical errors alone, that drops to 0.1 sigma after you marginalize over the foreground. So this was super depressing, and we spent a lot of time checking this and making sure that everything was done correctly.
Was that the reason it wasn't
funded? I don't think so. I mean, having seen the reviews, the criticism was much more focused on the polarization capabilities than the spectral distortion science. Yeah. The instrumentation is somewhat challenging because you're trying to do both a spectral measurement with this very transform spectrometer and also trying to do polarization simultaneously with the same instrument. And nobody has demonstrated that yet. Okay, so this is depressing. However, we've been thinking about ways to modify the mission concept to actually get a forecast that would be able to detect mu in the presence of all these foregrounds. So it turns out you can make some simple modifications that look like they get you there. You do always basically have to improve sensitivity to some extent, but with a somewhat larger mission than PIXE, which was just a mid-X mission like WMAP, this might be feasible. In particular, what you want is to add some low frequency coverage. So down here below, say a couple hundred gigahertz, you have all these different foregrounds that are picking up that you're trying to component separate. But your number of channels in the FTS is linearly spaced, so you don't have that many frequency channels down there. So if you just add some dedicated low frequency spectrometer, a second instrument, which is down here at those low frequencies, then if you just put this setup into our code, you get a 5 sigma detection of mu. And this was just like a first try. We didn't do any sort of optimization to get to this. So the hope is that we can find some configuration which doesn't require a huge amount of increased sensitivity, but just a somewhat sort of modified frequency coverage at low frequency that will let us get there. One hope that I have is that experimentalists might come up with other concepts beyond Fourier transform spectrometers to let us have more flexibility in how we pick the frequency coverage of this absolutely calibrated measurement. So the PIXE situation was disappointing, but I do think that it's worth looking into this going forward, and we're writing a science book sort of highlighting a lot of this stuff in the next year. All right, so just to wrap up, hopefully I convinced you that there's a lot of interesting things to learn from spectral distortions. and that it's worth going after this. I'm totally out of time, so I'll just leave up this summary slide about foregrounds in the CMB and take any questions. Thanks.
Can you go back to that the power spectrum plot for the CDM, but primarily power spectrum?
Mm-hmm. This one.
So that's
yeah.
One. So I just wanted to point out that now we have a constraint at 10 to the 6 there, and it's around 10 to the minus 9, in fact, or 10 to the minus 8 to the minus 9. And this is from light curves of surrounding lens quasars.
This is a constraint on the primordial power spectrum?
Well, yeah. Right. Well, so I mean, you have to convert, so it's based on fluctuations of light curves, but then you have to have some order for nonlinear structure formation.
Right. So on this, like, I think the goal is to try to show basically only things that don't involve those types. The ultra-compact mini-halo ones totally are, and this plot is actually out of date. I think that people have actually even pushed upward arguing about that modeling. But the other ones, I mean, the primordial black holes, I think,
are sure,
robust. CMB linear theory-based ones are also under control, and then the mu distortion would also be similarly under control.
That was the model, yeah. So this, if that does happen, it would be less model-dependent than what we've done, because, of course, we are using very nonlinear structures on some model of a structure format.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But nevertheless, so within uncertainties of the model, which is, it's not like an exotic model, which is, I mean, those ultra-compact mini-halos that are kind of, that's based on assuming a dark matter as annihilation.
Oh, totally. Right? Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, there's just the fact that nonlinear structures do form, just exactly how many of them form.
So what number? You said you're at 10 to the minus 9?
It's just below, is it around 10 to the minus 8 or just below that? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I
just put that
to paper
a couple of days ago.
Yeah, I think I saw the abstract.
I'm sort of curious why the default pixie design went up to like a few characters.
Yeah. The basic story with that is that you essentially just get these for free. I mean, you synthesize the frequency bins afterward, but the highest frequency that you get is just set by your sampling rate, I think. So the information is just already there, essentially. One argument that people make is that you could improve the overall signal to noise by cutting this off with some filter at high frequencies. That way you don't get the sort of background noise that comes from the bright dust emission. In practice, I don't know. I mean, for the science case itself, people are thinking about intensity mapping using various spectral lines that are up there. But for the purposes of all this type of stuff we did, we actually just cut it off at like, I think 2 terahertz, because all the relevant information for the type of stuff that we're doing, basically. Once you go above the peak of these modified black bodies, that information is not useful really for determining what's going on down here. Did you have one more question?
I guess I'm just thinking, is there a simple way to understand why these are linearly spaced in frequency? I guess it must be some sort of resonance frequency of the cavity or something.
Yeah, I think that, right. I think it's just that the frequency bin width is just given by the inverse of the maximum, what's called the stroke of the Fourier transform spectrometer. And so that's just some number like delta L, and then the bins that you synthesize have to be integer multiples of that. So that also sets what your lowest frequency bin is on the left.
So what's next for Pixie?
I don't know if Pixie is going to be revived under this current name, for example. I'm not sure exactly. In the near term, the next thing that's happening in this field experimentally is that there's a concept in France called Pristine, which has just been developed in the last couple of months, actually. And that's being proposed to CNES. So it's not even a European project, it's just French. It's similar to Pixie, but slightly descoped, I think. I think it's more, I mean, you're guaranteed basically to detect a Y-type distortion, for example. And ideally, they would also be able to get these relativistic corrections. So I'd view it more as like a demonstrator than a like primordial physics machine. There's also people trying to do stuff from the ground. There's an Italian group who's building an experiment down at Dome C in Antarctica to try to detect the Y-type distortion from the ground. Very challenging because you need a huge frequency coverage and the atmosphere is doing all kinds of crazy stuff. In terms of an experiment that could actually detect mu, we're going to have to basically go back to the drawing board and come up with something that's modified but is not $10 billion. I mean, I think a sort of probe class, like $1 billion mission, can probably be designed that can get there. And then the question would be, if we propose that, like, can we get enough support for it? I don't know. It was difficult because a lot of the community in the CMB world mostly just wants to do R in terms of the primordial physics, whereas I think the motivation from you is at least as strong as trying to do R. This is nice because you have a guaranteed predicted signal. So I'd say the roadmap is a little bit unclear, but there is still a lot of things happening. All right, thanks.